I'll serve as moderator, try to keep us on track and watch time. And then I even wrote up here some suggestions of ways we might get started. Like, if you wanted to say one thing in my congregation that excites me is, and one thing in my congregation I'm concerned about is, another kind of a thing, or one thing I wish my congregation would do, it'd keep it pretty much focused where we hope the focus would stay, and that's in the congregation. We could also have a discussion about the Senate or district or other things too, but we'd like to keep it there. My job too, I'll accept, is to try and keep it positive as well as negative. If you have maybe 18 negative things in a row, I'll try to plug in and say, well, how about let's find a positive thing to say too. I'm hoping that that balance will come by itself. Then maybe after some time of doing that, well, I would hope that we could go 20 or 30 minutes even, if you would like, of just sharing. And then if the bishop doesn't understand what you're saying, if Herb doesn't understand, then he could ask a question for clarification. But essentially, we're inviting him to listen. Then after that, maybe we could have some dialogue back and forth in which you would get into some conversation with him. Is that sort of clear of what we're trying to be about tonight? Okay. So it's open. The floor is open for sharing with Bishop Chilstrom. And start with one of these or any other kind of thing that you might want to say. Nobody's on doubt. You don't have to speak for the whole congregation, by the way. You can just speak for yourself. That's why it says one thing that I'm excited about. Just speak for your own self.
One thing in our congregation that concerns me is the generation gap. There just seems to be the young people and the old people. There's a separation.
How does it show itself? Could I pursue it a little bit?
Well, for one thing, like ladies say, we can't get the young women interested in what we do at all. Or we can't, the older people plan something, the young people won't come. I mean, it's they're separated.
You can ride, you know, in tandem on it, and that suggests something, or you have a different experience, you know. Doesn't have to be all by yourself.
Right? But it's interesting to hear from a younger woman in another congregation who maybe isn't into the LCW for some reason.
As a pastor, and I've just been kind of watching this a little bit because our congregation is kind of a downtown large congregation, and I'm fairly new there, so I explored this a little bit because I noticed some of the older women were saying that. I just wish that we could get younger women to serve at these funeral suppers and at these different or meals or receptions or whatever they call them. And we'd like to be dropping out. And but then in talking to the some of the younger women about helping out in some of that, they said that's true, but the minute we do enter into that and say we'll take over this particular funeral, the older one is there hovering over the whole thing and saying, now that's not the way it's done, do it this way, we'll set the table up this way, this is the way we usually set it up, and continually never really letting go and let them sink or swim on their own. And so the younger one says, all right, they want to be here anyway, even though we are here. And if they can't trust us enough to take care of a simple little serving of lunch, what's the use? They still don't want to give it up. They just want to have someone do the work, and they hover over to keep control of it. And I think that without realizing it, this tends to happen. It's hard to give up something.
Yes. Well, I was going to say, I guess I fit sort of halfway in between. I don't think I'm older, and I guess I'm not younger anymore either. Maybe I never was either. But I know that one thing I've noticed is that, for instance, when our kids are confirmed, we say, you are a full member of the church. You know, you are now an adult member of the church. And yet, when those same kids volunteer to do things, they're not asked to sing solos for the church services. That's an adult function. They don't want them ushering. That's an adult function. So if you tell those kids at 15 and 16 that these are adult functions, then when they get to be 20, they say, well, you know, we are, you know, what's changed? We've only changed by a few years. We haven't become a new kind of member. You know, there's not a second confirmation at 18 or 21. So they didn't want us at 15 and 16. Why would they want us now? You know, that's one kind of feedback I hear. The other thing is, I think that with women, LCW at least, is that most of us work, or we have little babies. And I don't know how many churches really set up their meetings. You know, I mean, serving funerals, obviously, you can't plan the funeral or for evening around the working women. But on the other hand, you know, does anybody, when they call me and want a cake, does anybody say, I know you have to be at work before 8 o'clock in the morning. If you drop the cake off at my house, I would take it to church. You know, the church isn't open before 8 o'clock in the morning, and I leave for work.
Thanks, John. I think it's a mistake not to ask the young boys not to usher. I know, as an example, our church, we came from the Midwest, and there were two of us that did the ushering. We only had a congregation of about 60 families. There were two of us that did the ushering for, many, many years, until one day I heard that, and I was on a church board, too, and we had all been on a church board for quite a number of years, and one fella grumbled. He says, it's the same old gang running everything. And so I resigned from the church board and ushering, and I asked them to appoint two young fellows to be the ushers. And consequently, some of the other fellows resigned from the board, and we got new men in. Now, we've been going back to this little town quite a few times since we moved out here, and they still have young fellows that are ushering. There's a lot of young fellows that are taking an interest in the church, and I think it's a mistake not to ask these young fellows to get in there and get involved.
We had somewhat that same situation in our congregation until a few years ago. We changed our constitution to where you couldn't serve more than two terms in an office. And in that way, the offices get passed around. And our church council right now is at least half, probably more than half, young people. Women as well as men.
More on this or another subject?
I might just add a comment before we move away from it, and that is this, that in our synagogue, I see a growing number of churches that are doing things on what they call the cross-generational pattern, which really basically planning activities without aiming at a certain age group. In other words, if there's a backpack, why shouldn't you have people from 8 to 80 if they want to make the trip? And what happens after a while is that when you build these kind of activities, you build relationships, and then I think you begin to break down some of the barriers that keep people from just simply going into an established group and finding that they really aren't very welcome. Some have even scrapped their traditional youth program, and they do all of their activities on a cross-generational pattern.
Somebody else? Oh,
yes, go ahead. Well, listening to the greeters and everything, one thing that I'm excited about. about in our congregation is we've seen this problem and we turn it into a project. And with that, we have families as readers and also whole families as ushers. And we feel they're our frontline evangelists. And they're the team, smiling, and greeting them and hugging them. And it just creates a family relationship. We don't worry about the age. We let them know the importance of their job. And they're frontline evangelists and greet them like they might not ever see them again. We found out it was exciting.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay to brag tonight about good things like that. That's great. Yes?
I think the thing that excites me in our congregation, and I mentioned it at one of the sessions a little bit earlier, is a series of support kinds of groups that we're doing that are may or may not be led by one of the pastors, may be led by someone who's concerned. We call them koinonia groups. But they meet on things like chemical dependency or grief or relationships between people, a variety of kinds of things. And I think that's a real exciting idea and a way to open up relationships, and those are cross-generational. Anybody can come.
Who knows what the Bethel Bible Series is? Who doesn't know what the Bethel Bible Series is? Just a few. But you want to say just a special series of studying the scripture over a lengthy period of time.
Over 2 years.
2 years.
With a new group every 2 years, and it's self-propagating, and it's exciting. And it's, what's your appetite for Bible study?
Intensive study experiences.
No, but Bethel Bible Series is not really intensive. It's an overview.
Okay. I just get that. I guess what it keeps going, the same group keeps going over
2 years.
Yeah.
I'm excited about it also. Having just finished the study of the Old Testament, it was very, very worthwhile. There are visual aids used, large pictures, and there are concepts to be learned. We're almost set up with a set of flashcards, so we learn the concept on one side and then we learn the chapter and the book of the Bible from which it's taken on the other side. And then we get some tests in between. They're good to pull together all the loose ends. It's very worthwhile.
Someone else? Anybody with a wish for their congregation, or with a wish our congregation would?
I'm excited. I don't work in it. They're constantly clamoring for extra ladies to help because the demand is there. We have made provision in the basement and have taken over the stage, so to speak, which wasn't used very much anyway, for a clothing bank to which members of the congregation bring the type of clothing a lady might put on for a thrift sale. The ladies working in the clothing bank sort everything. They sew a lot. One of them even makes little panties for little children, the cutest little things you ever did see. So many of these ladies give this clothing bank a personal touch. But who comes to it? An unwed mother, a family that's just burned out, some fellows down the road who might have been referred by a local policeman. Other referrals come from social agencies in the city, and it's just created a lot of fine feeling among the ladies that are working in the clothing bank. And nobody's ever said we don't have enough space. We're simply told, don't bring your spring things, you know, in the winter, and don't bring your unseasonal things for this season. Just hold back until a little later. We'll accept it all later.
And do people buy these things? Or
they're all donated.
No, I mean the people who come in to get them.
No, it's given.
Given.
Mm-hmm. No strings attached.
Do you have quite a few people
come for clothing?
Yes. It's surprising who does come and the number that do come. It's open a certain day or two a week. Other times open for the preparation of the clothing, but for the actual coming in to take of the amount there, it's open a certain number of days. I don't know all the specifics, but it's been very, very successful. And it really, you know, helped to take care of a great need in the community, which ordinarily one wouldn't feel. Somebody had felt a need for this. And I believe it was one of our pastors.
Thank you. Someone else? Yes.
One of the exciting things we've seen in our church was when we could have the freedom to be able to hug or touch each other. We see so many times the formal things, and what an exciting feeling it is, just like the family here passing the peace. And as we apply it in our church, the freedom to put our arms around and hug, it seems like it turns the whole family. And as people come in, strangers, to pick up the spirit, the fear to shake hands and touch, and they're pretty before long, they're looking forward to being hugged or hugged. And we find it really tight, a church member here.
Yes?
Our congregation is a thing that excites me. Has found the freedom to, at the end of the service, for the prayer of the church, to express from the congregation petitions, very personal petitions, and then along with those come the thanks when those prayers are answered, and that's just really exciting.
Are there any other congregations that do that? Include petitions from the congregation when you have prayer? Are there any others that do that? A number in our area do it. I just wondered whether it was more widespread than that.
One thing our pastor used to do whenever there was a baptism, he would invite the little children to come up around there, and he'd give a little talk to the youngsters, and then he would baptize the baby, and I think that made quite an impression on the children, but that didn't last too long. I don't know why.
You mean he doesn't do that anymore?
No. They haven't done it for about a while. Now during baptism, they have it up in front of the pews, and they light a candle.
One thing our church does, I don't know whether it's traditional or others or not, but during the Eucharist, the children come up with their parents to the altar rail, and the pastor says to each child, God bless you. And one little child, when he asked what he liked the best about the church, that was his reply. His very little child.
Yes, please.
I'm wondering to what extent the Lutheran magazine is encouraged by the various congregations to maybe the whole mass mailing, or I know it's an individual church thing, but I belong to a church, really a big church. If I didn't know there was that magazine, I'd never be getting it. And I don't know whose responsibility, or if it's a pastor who encourages, or the council, or if it's the Lutheran staff, they should be putting some, making it more aware. I don't know. Any response to something like that?
Maybe some of the other folks can respond.
Well, I think in two churches we've been involved in one of them, it was a matter of somebody assuming responsibility for encouraging the sale of it, you know, the cost of $2 a year or whatever it was, and somebody had to go out and try to encourage people to do it. In the other congregation I'm aware of, at one time I think the council had considered sending it to everybody in the congregation, and for whatever reason, I don't know, that was discontinued or not followed up, but I think it should be, really. It's an excellent thing. But you hardly know it exists.
Ben belongs to an ALC congregation in the northern Wisconsin district. And now for several years, it's been a district-wide policy for all the congregations to send the Lutheran standard into every home, and the congregation pays for it. I think it's 2.5 a year for subscription, something like that. And of the congregations in our conference, at least, I think there's only one that hasn't gone along with that. So at least in our conference, the people do have the church publication. And I think that's, I'm sure ours isn't the only district in the ALC that does it. I can't speak for the other synods.
Well, in the LCA, it's a voluntary matter in the congregation. Many churches do have the every home plan. But I think in the ALC, the plan is somehow subsidized by the district, so it isn't quite as costly for the local church.
I think it costs 2.5
per gallon. We have many LCA churches that do have the every home plan, and the others, they are supposed to have some to encourage individual subscriptions. I think it may be of interest to you to know that the two Lutheran publications, the Lutheran Magazine and the Lutheran Standard, are the largest circulation religious magazines in America. So in spite of the fact that we don't get a lot of homes, we do get a phenomenal number of homes. I think the combined circulation would probably be about 1,100,000, something like that.
Someone else? Yes.
I wish my congregation would have a better youth program, youth lead effectiveness, something.
Okay. Somebody want to build on that?
Well, I teach in a Christian college, and one of the classes I teach is church youth leadership. And I think this quarter, this year, five churches have employed these five different students all over the United States. But I think if it's a young or old, regardless of how old the congregation is, I think the best $10,000-$12,000 you can spend is to get a church, get a youth pastor, because they can relate to the kids, they're exciting. I think they pay for themselves in an average-sized congregation as many times over. And I think there are people who are trained and who can do it. I think pastors are, they can do it probably, but they got all they can do what they can do with their age group or above. And I just think kids are a lot more effective, and it's money well spent.
You think it needs to be an ordained person?
No. Everybody's a youth pastor, but someone with a lot of interest and.
I think a concern that, and it was part of what I said before about the generation gap, but I think the concern I see is the falling away of kids after confirmation. You have a pretty good sized confirmation class, and you sit there and you see all these kids lined up, and then, you know, the next year you wonder, gee, what happened to that 50 or 60 or 100 or whatever it was of kids, because oftentimes you just don't see them around. And I guess my wish is that there would be some way to get those kids more involved and keep them then, when they're still excited about church and so on, so that when they're 20 and 21 and 22 and 23 and getting married, that they'll come with their families.
In bed.
One, I've heard a lot of different, that same comment in a lot of different ways, and I think one response to that I would have is that in many cases those kids that are in confirmation are not excited about the church at all, and their confirmation is not an exciting thing for 90 1% of the kids, but and they're active maybe because their parents want them to be active in the confirmation program and are willing to make a lot of sacrifices to get them there and are willing to argue with them at the times when they don't want to go and take them there and take them home and make sure they've done their work and all this stuff. And after they're confirmed, in many cases, I think all of that ends. And also, in most churches, there's nothing else that interests them. And so I think it's a pretty natural phenomenon, a pretty worldwide phenomenon, that kids don't come after confirmation.
Oh, please. Yeah.
I would like to ask either you or the bishop on this confirmation thing. If you have heard, because in our congregation we're doing study and going to revamping our confirmation program. If you have heard, the confirmation initially was meant as an adult rite. Have you heard this fact before?
I think if you go back to the early Christian church, the very beginnings of the church, at a time when it was primarily a missionary endeavor, naturally the converts almost exclusively were adults. The children simply came along as part of the family. And if you went to places in the world today where you have more of a first century setting where you're into the first generation, there too you find that most of the converts are adults, and therefore confirmation tends to be an adult rite. I think what happened gradually in the European setting then was that confirmation became the rite that you completed before the young person at age 13 or 14 left home for America or for a job. And it was sort of a way of bringing to a conclusion the educational experience, also confirming the baptismal covenant.
Yeah, we're right now doing some real exciting things and have done research into confirmation and really what its purpose is. And we've read many different studies and things that have been put on by various synods of the Lutheran Church on confirmation. And the thing that has really struck us is that the age that we have confirmation right now in our churches, or a lot of churches have, is the age that we should not be trying to force feed these kids anything. It's an age in their life where it is more natural for them to question, to wonder, to ponder, to just to simply question their faith, that they've been brought up in. And so we are striving to make our confirmation more of a individual type thing for, you know, a child, adult, or whatever, when they want it, not necessarily a group of 15, 20 kids up there just because they've gone through 2 years of instruction saying that you can be confirmed now. And anyway, this is the area where our congregation is starting to, we're going to try some different methods of confirmation and see if we can improve on the program. But we're kind of excited about it.
Yeah, there are many churches that have gone into individualized confirmation program. One of the caution flags that we wave on that is whether they will, in the process of their individualized program, lose a sense of belonging to a community of believers, which you sometimes have a chance to accent in a classroom setting or by class activities. But I hear many good comments from churches that have gone that direction. But the whole question of age is a good one. When I was in the parish, I managed against much resistance to move the age of confirmation from the end of ninth grade to the end of 10th grade. And I found that just that 1 year, the maturity that a child, young adolescent goes through just in 1 year, say from age 14 to 15, is really phenomenal. And it was much more enjoyable to teach the 10th graders. But confirmation is a tough, it's a tough thing. I remember when one of our bishops was elected to office a couple of years ago, in his acceptance speech, he said that he was very nervous about taking office and wondered about all the things he had to do, but he said there was one consolation, and that was that he wouldn't have to teach confirmation anymore. but is I survey pastors, that is one area where there is a great deal of frustration. In the LCA now, we've got two things going for our pastors. One is a workshop on the pastor's teacher, and the other is a new confirmation program.
Gentlemen, back?
No? I think it's, if you look inside Martin Luther's small catechism, isn't there something about that the small catechism is written for parents and pastors or something like that, to teach their kids some of the tenets of the faith? And I think what I work for a large church. We have a large confirmation program, and it's really hard. It's really a burden. There's more staff meetings on that than on any other subject probably during the church year. And it's a very hard thing to do. And it would be good if some of that burden was taken off the pastors, but I think it is something that is placed squarely on the shoulders of the pastor to come up with and to teach and to administer confirmation program in ways that's unfortunate.
Please.
One of the things that our education committee is very excited about is the fact that our independent learning confirmation program, which has finally gotten the kinks out of it after a trial process of, I would say, at least 2 years, is now highly successful. Kids can work at their own speed with the use of tapes, booklets, and so on, with the help of lay teachers, and then finally, at the ends of certain contracted units, get consultation periods with the pastor, questioning by him before they proceed to the next. They may be confirmed at whichever speed they like. If they want to finish the program in a year's time, work with a real good friend that works at the same pace, that's fine. If they want to extend that time beyond that, whenever they're ready, they may be confirmed. And the final evaluation that I heard of it just recently was the fact that with the week's Bible class, you know, for the little tots, for the first time there was seen a great number of the young girls that had been recently confirmed. They were volunteering to be teachers, and they were wanting to teach the little kids. So here was an end result of the confirmation program. Finally, they had found a place where they could feel that they were wanted and needed, and our pastor felt that it was a result of the confirmation program, which gave each of the girls, now a teacher, a one-on-one consultation basis and a thorough understanding of what her faith and Christianity was all about.
Thank you. Someone else? Yes, sir.
Their church also lets one of their pastors spend 50% of his time on confirmation.
He spends a great deal of his time on confirmation, yes.
How many students do you have?
I have no idea.
Long confirmation. Large congregation?
Yes, very good.
Gentlemen, right here.
Yes, on away from confirmation, on the subject of money, we're a church of, I guess, 800 or thereabouts, with a $250,000 budget or thereabouts, and I'm proud to report that we gave 35% in benevolences of our general giving last year, which is, I think, was the best in the district. The minus is that the giving, it represents about 1 to 2% of income in a country club type church. Substantial, a great number of six-figure incomes. And as a third-year council member, I've proposed over and over that we post names and amounts given monthly in the church, identifying and perhaps shaming people into giving more. Needless to say, that doesn't get many votes, but we're going to persist anyway. The giving level is an obscenity. It's so low. The commitment in giving is incredible. And yet we have given a lot away out of the, we've externalized a lot of them.
Thank you. Others?
I was a part of a congregation many years ago who used to do that, and it was the biggest gossip sheet you ever saw in your life.
That's. I think that's great. I'm all for that.
Good luck.
I also was part of a congregation that used to do that, and we voted to quit it. And the treasurer was really upset. He says, we won't have money enough for anything. Well, actually, the giving did not go down, and every year, we're a small congregation with no quarter of a dollar budget or anything like that. But nevertheless, the giving didn't drop off because people weren't giving to see their name published. Although the treasurer was sure that it would fall way down.
Someone else? Yes.
I don't think Paul was referring to meeting the budget. Budget is an obscenity, as far as I'm concerned, in our church. You can get too business-like about some of the things that are going on. Balance sheets, bottom lines, income statements. That's not the world of a Christian. I think what Paul was referring to was not just meeting the budget, but being able to take the potential that lies within a congregation, within 800 people who profess to be Christians, and be able to move some of that potential to the outside world, to do things, to take some of the potential and accomplish some of the things that we would all like to see done, that aren't being done. We live in a world that has 2 billion people who go hungry or are starving, and it's really hard. It's hard to look at that, to go and see a film that we saw the other night at the center, and then go back to your church and realize that we're up against a problem that's epidemic inside the church, inside of our own congregation, that we're all a part of in one way or another. And that's, I think, what Paul was addressing, that it's so frustrating to be part of what Bonhoeffer would call cheap grace.
But is it our place to judge what that other person, whatever his income is, he is giving, and we don't know what they're giving, outside the church. I mean, outside of your church building. And I guess the kind of thing of listing the names, I think, could be very dangerous because you don't know what else they're doing.
Somebody else? Yes, sir.
This is an informational request, I guess. When I was in high school in an ALC church, they had quite an active world hunger program. They had organized what we called hunger teams, and there were conventions and such like that. Now I belong to an LCA church, which is not in Minnesota, but there you don't hear a word. In fact, when we mentioned it at a committee meeting, we said, well, this budget figure for several years ago had all this money for that, and now it's gone. And they said, well, that was Bangladesh, that's over. And I just don't, does the LCA have an ongoing program on that? Are we missing out?
What you're talking about is local pride. At our convention in Seattle, we voted to extend the World Hunger Appeal for another 10 years. And there's an avalanche of material available for any congregation that wants to promote it. So the stopper is at the local level.
Well, I guess I knew about the social justice motion and stuff, but.
That was a separate issue.
Okay, I guess what I'm asking is this place for this to come, do we have to yell and holler from here, or is there some way to get help to kind of nudge in the other direction too?
Well, we have, I don't know you, I don't know who your local pastor is, I don't know where you're from, so I'm safe to say this, I guess, and that is that we have kind of a saying among presidents and bishops that if we can just get past the local pastor, maybe the lay people will get things going. This happens with program after program. It just dies on the pastor's desk. And in contrast to your congregation, we can point to other congregations that have done a magnificent job in the second mock giving to the World Hunger Appeal.
Every month, your pastor receives a thing called the AIM package, AIM. And in there, every month, there are materials that pertain to Rough Compelled Action World Hunger Appeal. and he gets it out, like, what time of the month does it come out of? It's usually all about, you know, about a half an inch of stick, of all kinds of things, from social ministry to education, to world hunger, to youth, to everything.
Before somebody tracks down where we're from, it might be only fair to say that he's new in the area, so maybe it's on his list.
Ask him where his AIM packet is.
In that AIM packet, there's a monthly newsletter from the World Hunger Appeal Office, and many pastors just simply translate that and reduplicate it for distribution with their monthly parish newsletter, or at least take part of it.
One thing I'm concerned about within our church is how do we determine, when we admit new members in a ceremony, how do we determine who those new members are when they come to services in Sundays following, so that the old members will know who the new members are, because if you see them just once when you have a special ceremony, you know, after they're admitted as members in the church, sometimes you cannot always spot those faces, or they go to another service. Often we define who those people are so that the older members can show their appreciation and their friendliness to those that are new. What do other churches do to assist?
We just visited our daughter's church in Portland. There's one of the members that makes little red roses out of ribbons. And the greeters, when they ask these people if they don't know them, when they come in, if they're new for the Sunday, and they say they are, they pin a little red rose on their lapel. So all the new ones for the day are wearing red roses on their lapel. And they keep these.
Are they green flowers then?
No. Just made of ribbon. But they look like a little rose. And so the congregation knows those that are new for the day. That was a key one.
We take Polaroid pictures of our new members and have them on a banner for about a year with their names and the date they're taking them.
I have always heard that the Lutheran Church is such a cold church. We don't go out of our way to greet the people that come to our church.
What's your experience?
Well, I remember when we first came to Tacoma, came on a visit, and there was came out of church, and there was a man who came up to me and took hands with me and introduced himself. And a few years later, we moved to Tacoma, went to church, and came out of church, and the same man came up, put his hand out, and took hands and introduced himself. It was the same man that had greeted me when we were visitors. And I know I'm as guilty as anybody else, that I don't go out of my way to greet somebody, and I've heard it said time and again that you Lutherans are too cold.
Back there?
Well, I was new to Minneapolis this year, and I attended a variety of Lutheran churches, and I found a variety of responses. You know, there were some churches where nobody said anything to you, and it was just cool. And others where I had all kinds of people coming up to me, talking to me, greeting me, asking me about myself. So I think it really varies from congregation. I always make a generalization.
Does anyone have churches where they ask the visitors to stand up during the worship?
Yes, I'd like to ask, I have not seen any information as to what sort of things came before the convention in Seattle. And I'd just like to ask what statements were adopted in two of the really tough issues that the church has faced, one of homosexuality and one of abortion. I wonder if somebody could comment as to what, if any, motions were adopted by this convention on those issues.
There were no actions taken on either of those issues. There was a resolution regarding homosexuality, and the convention was told that the Division for Mission in North America is in the process of developing a more general social statement which would address itself in part to that. And the convention more or less agreed to wait for the appearance of that statement. But I was there for everything, and there were no formal resolutions on the board.
We had a forum last week on the convention here at 1IGG. A number of folks who had been there and talked about the variety of things, but that's the question. Others? Yes.
I guess one thing in my congregation I'm concerned about is that there is a tendency, I think, in our congregations as Lutherans to become more and more middle class and upper middle class. And as I mentioned, the congregation that I'm with is kind of in the downtown area, but we're really not serving that area as well as I think we might, partly because around the church are becoming more and more poor people and more and more people who are not up to the intellectual standards probably of the rest of the congregation, because we've got a lot of university people there. And I have sometimes asked the council on retreats how they would feel about us really showing the kind of love and warmth to those people in the immediate community that are not of the same cultural background as the regular members, how they would feel about that. And there seems to be, although there's a hesitance to really come out and talk about it, there is a hesitance at really opening the doors wide and showing some degree of affection and warmth. And I'm afraid almost to, as soon as we do show some warmth to some of the people, getting involved with them when they get into trouble and so forth, all of a sudden you have 20 people surrounding me, and I think it would be a very easy thing if we could show some real warmth to those people. They would, I think, almost flood the church. And yet, if they get the cold shoulder when they get there, I'm scared to death that they might be hurt even more than they are by us not having a strong invitation to them at this point. So one thing I'm concerned about in my congregation is, what direction are we going to take in the community in which we're looking?
Well, I have very feeling about what you're saying. And my feeling is that we have to change the mentality of our congregations from thinking of themselves as institutions or congregations within kind of a territory, to more of, I think, a Roman Catholic and also a European concept, that this area around our church, however many square blocks, is the place where God has placed us as a congregation to serve. In other words, the mentality tends to be pretty much what George Anderson was talking about this morning. Our attempt in evangelism is to go out and get that person, to bring him into the church to help us to keep this thing going. And that's the exact reverse of the New Testament idea, that we are a ministering and servant people to this area. In Minneapolis, St. Paul, we have gone through a very intensive 2-year urban strategy program. Within the Beltline around Minneapolis and St. Paul, we have 89 LCA congregations. There are 90 ALC churches in that same territory, and I suppose about 50 Missouri Synod. And one of the heartaches was that we couldn't do an inter-Lutheran thing there, just because of our different jurisdictions, we just couldn't carry it off, so we had to go alone LCA. But out of it is coming a parish concept, the idea that congregations in a certain community are not to be in competition with one another, but to cooperate in being servants in that community.
And I think when we change the mentality, then I think we have some hope of reaching people in the community. But if they sense that they're just the object of our efforts to get them to support the institution, then I think we're good.
Yeah, question I have in regard to that same thing. Do we then also need to perhaps change or revise our Lutheran service? You know, I thoroughly enjoy the services in the LBW, and yet it seems to me that for the most part we are reaching out with our liturgy and our service to those who understand the liturgy and the service, and not necessarily to either those who are outside the Lutheran faith or even perhaps those who maybe are coming from a different background than what we have right now.
Well, again, I got a very strong opinion on that. You know,
we're at the end. You're supposed to be listening to 5 minutes late, so.
I really feel that that's a stereotype that is wrong. And I think Exhibit A is what happened in Center City, Philadelphia, where we had all these old German and Swedish and Danish Lutheran churches, which were abandoned 25 years ago. And people fled to the suburbs, and people said, let's go with our people out there. And fortunately, there were some people with vision who said, no, we stay here, because as a Lutheran church, we've been called to serve all people. And the next temptation was to yield to the idea that, well, these people are not of Lutheran background. They're mainly Assemblies of God, Pentecostal-type people, Baptists and so on. They're blacks, they have a different background and so on. And so what we want to do is do their kind of service. But again, there were those who insisted that, no, we have a rich heritage which these people may very well appreciate. They stuck to it. Our church 25 years ago in Center City, Philadelphia, had less than 500 black members. Now we have more than 5,000. We have a congregation with 1,000 members, 95% black, and they have the full worship, LBW Sunday, mostly black faces. They have weekly Eucharist. And one of the interesting things that happened last year is that the churches in Center City, Philadelphia, black and Spanish speaking, they grew to all churches that had weekly celebration of sacraments. In other words, these people are saying, hey, we've discovered that you have a great treasure in the liturgy that we're glad you're now sharing with us. That is not to say that we don't do those other kind of things. And just the fact that we saw people here who in the setting of LBW have free prayer, that's a pretty neat thing.
Yeah, also, weren't some of the changes in some wordings made to kind of bring in, Chuck Anderson explained some of the things to us in a special service when we started the new hymnal. And one of the things that made sense to me out of what he was saying was that some of the changes were made specifically to adapt to the new generation of people who are coming into the Lutheran Church. And the one example I remember out of that, there were others, was that what's the difference between in the Lord's Prayer, forever, and forever and ever? You can't get any further than forever, so you don't need the extra ever. And that maybe, you know, the new people into the church who are not of, maybe even from a Christian tradition even, don't understand forever and ever. Forever makes sense to them. So that was the...
Well, I'd just like to comment on the form of the worship service as far as regards to our church, and maybe a little bit different from what you said, and that it's had an adverse effect, I believe, on our church, and that our attendance has gone down, and the way the liturgy was conducted, it was conducted with all the trappings possible. And the letters that we got on the executive and the personnel committee was comments like a circus and a show and a parade, and our attendance has suffered from it. We have three services. We have one at 8:30, which is a contemporary, and we have very, very little liturgy. and the attendance is consistently high. We're close to a college, so when school's out, it drops somewhat in the summer. But normally we're around 250 to, about 250 probably is about as many as we get in there in the summer. And it drops, or in the winter rather, in the summer it drops a little. But the other services, this is a large church, the sanctuary holds what, town 750? 800?
About 750, 800.
Okay, the services have been running 125 to 200. And we feel it's a direct result of this LBW and the way our pastors have presented the liturgy. And another comment that we've had is the music in the LBW. I'm not talking about the liturgy, I'm talking about the songs. Extremely difficult to sing, extremely difficult music for the average person.
That's right. Lots of complaints on the hymnal part of the LBW.
We get letters. We get many letters.
Yeah, and our choir complains because they think they're too, you know, when you've narrowed down the range, some of our members who are either choir members or musicians say, there's nothing to sing anymore. You can't win.
When we changed from the red hymnal to the new one, we sat down and took a year's bulletins. I'll let you do that, you find out how few of the songs in that book you ever sang, in the old red book. I'll bet there weren't 100 songs in most congregations out of that 500 and some that are written in the book. And you can't tell me that you can't find enough songs in this new book that people can sing that should. I can't see why it's so unsatisfying.
No, but unfortunately, the congregation has very little to say about what songs are sung.
Well,
we have zero to say about it. It's up to the organist.
You hire the pastor, you should be able to tell him.
Well,
one of the things that we did when we introduced it, we sang Amazing Grace and How Great Thou Art about three Sundays in a row. And we told them that these songs would not have been in the red hymnal. And from then on, they were ready to take it in.
Lady in back, we're getting to 10 o'clock.
That just led me to another question. Have there been any movement in any of the Lutheran synods, as far as you know, to limit the term of pastorate? I don't know if the Catholic Church, but I think the Methodist Church, the Episcopalian churches have a limit so that, you know, there is a free turning of the pastor.
It is possible now in the LPA to call a pastor for a term and then to renew that at the end of that term. And I think it's possible, I know it's possible in the ALC, it has been for a number of years.
But there's no limit that says a man will not stay in a congregation longer than 10 years. This is what I'm wondering.
Well, in other words, when a congregation calls a pastor, they may either call him for an indefinite period of time or for a definite period of time. If the church says we call you for 4 years, at the end of that 4 years, the call expires unless they renew it.
Mm-hmm.
Am I answering?
That's
your
on the congregational level.
Yes.
But there's nothing from above.
Oh,
no. Okay, that's what I was wondering.
One person that I had talked to on that very subject is a lady from California. She said, you know, there's a great deal of folly in that idea that you have, because with any group of people, we find that they move on an average every third year. So she says, the congregation changes. Why do we have to change pastors? Because after all, you're listening to us.
We have run up to our 10 o'clock deadline. I was going to be, because the bishop listens so well. Do you have any final word you want to say to the group?
Oh, thank you.
All right. Thank you much. You want to stay around and chat with them? You're certainly welcome.